A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
This is a story about wrong turns.
It was evening. Do you think it was just going dark, about 5 o'clock?
The small course corrections that just change everything.
Yeah, so I'm at his door now and I'm knocking. There's no answer. I've even shouted through the letterbox. There's no answer. So yeah, I went back and said, there's no one in. There's no answer. And they've immediately come out, come to the door and kicked the door in.
It's a story about mistakes and how we take responsibility for them.
As soon as I've gone in behind him, I can see the old man sat in the corner. And you can tell straight away there's nothing in the house, it's just an old man's house. So yeah, straight away I'm saying, there's nothing in here, we just might as well leave. So I just wanted to get out of there.
But it's mostly about a man called John who starts off weak and becomes strong. And a woman called Jan with a fire burning inside her. I'm David Taylor, and this week on the Slow Newscast, we're talking, I'm afraid, about violence and death, and about what happens when the justice system gets something wrong, but can't really face the consequences of its mistakes. So I headed up to Cambridge on a warm, wet day to meet John Crilly. It was muggy and rain started hammering down as we walked through the terraced streets that were hugging the railway line. And John had the door open as we approached.
Hello.
Hey, John.
All right,
how you doing?
Yeah, do you
want
to come in?
Yeah, I'd love to.
It's a nice little housing association, one bedroom flat. He'd only just moved in a week ago.
How long have you been in here?
About a week.
Oh, really? As quick as that?
How
is it? It looks nice.
It's all right, yeah. Cool.
But you could tell he was trying to make a home.
It's got a room?
Yeah, I love it.
What have you got? Coffee or?
Coffee?
I'd just love a black coffee, please.
Sugar.
Two vases of red and yellow gladioli on the windowsills and a Manchester United calendar on the kitchen cupboard.
So you're a United fan?
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. Where do you want
us to... So let's talk about that burglary. A terrible day in 2005 when a 71-year-old man called Augustine Madamasia was killed by a single punch. John Crilly was in another room when this defenceless old man was punched. But he was convicted anyway for murder and given a minimum of 20 years in jail. John was a heroin addict and he admitted to me that for most of the murder trial he could barely grasp what was going on. By that time he'd spent 10 years or more in and out of prison. He was in this hopeless, repetitive pattern of taking drugs, shoplifting and stealing cars to buy more drugs. But it wasn't always like that. John's life was pretty good at first.
I was born in Manchester, a place called Harper Hay, on a council estate, typical normal council estate. I had an Irish mother and father, first generation just come over. And I had an older sister, we lived in Harper Hay, and I had an amazing childhood.
You can tell from the way he speaks about it, he used to love school. But then in secondary school, he started to get into fights, to find trouble. His mum, Winifred, Winnie, took him out of school before he was expelled, and he ended up in a remedial school where he mostly learned from other lads how to steal cars more efficiently. This was the 1980s, and cars were really easy to get into and steal. But the first transformative moment in John's life came when he was 18. He was working as a labourer with his dad, and he just headed off to the pub to collect his cash in hand wages. And before long, he was dragged out.
My sister's boyfriend came in and dragged me out. Said, "You need to come home." I just knew. I got home, and my mum had been at the traffic lights on her way to work that morning, and a council wagon went up the curb and took her out.
John's mum, Winnie, was at the heart of all that was good in his life growing up. His dad pushed him away as he struggled with his own grief. His sister had a boyfriend, and on the very same day that his mum died, John's girlfriend dumped him and said she wouldn't let him see their baby son. So he was alone, and he fell apart. He'd tried heroin once before, he said, and hated it. But here he is, he's aged 18, in this moment of catastrophic upheaval, and he went looking for the drug dealers on his estate.
Obviously, when I was in that position, I went straight to them.
And were you doing that, you were looking for some sort of oblivion, or were you actually...
I wanted to talk myself.
Did you really?
Yeah, it was just a mad quick decline. I was just injecting every day then.
Throughout the 90s, he was in and out of prison.
I went to jail every single year, but only for like 3-6 months. Because, like I say, it was only pinching cars or shoplifting.
In prison, access to drugs was even easier than it was outside. The dealers there made a beeline for the new prisoners. And the years rolled by. John regularly overdosed, regularly got arrested and sentenced to months in prison. It was a pretty degrading life. Weakness, addiction, crime. And by the early 2000s, he wasn't shoplifting anymore to fund his habit. Instead, he was dealing drugs. He was set up with a supplier while he was in prison, connected with a former school friend, a help who became his driver. And John, as he puts it, he became pretty successful at dealing. And so for a while he was in a different rhythm of criminality, working with a driver, selling drugs, and making money to fund his own heroin addiction. Then, in February 2005, came the day that changed John's life. He had a new driver, foisted on him by his heroin supplier. It was a man called David Flynn, and that's where things began to go wrong.
Yeah, basically, I've got another bud on board.
And who was he?
David Flynn, turned out to be. Because I've also moved from my area. I'm not in my area where I grew up. It's not miles away, but I don't know everyone like I do where I grew up. So, yeah, I've just got this David Flynn driving for me now, and he's got a bird, and they're both taking drugs. So the drugs just start going down, profits just start going down.
Really?
Because it's got four of us now. There was two, me and my driver, and now I've got him and his bird.
Suddenly, they were having to find other means of getting funds to pay the guys who were their drug suppliers, men who carried guns around and definitely weren't people to get on the wrong side of.
I didn't have all the money for my dealer. So my original driver used to be a burglar as well, and the new driver... Turned out he's ever done is burglaries as well, so immediately started talking about doing burglaries. But obviously they say you don't shit on your own doorstep. We used to drive out the area. We've done about 3 burglaries, I think. We've done 2 out the area, and the next day they just come out with a bottle of whiskey. I was sent to knock on the door, and I was happy with that because I don't like burglaries.
John had only committed a burglary once before, and he'd been scared to death by it.
The first ever offence I did was a burglary when I was 13 with an older kid. He took me on a burglary, and a Chinese guy come out the house with a pair of nunchakers, And I just shit myself. From that day, I've never really done burglaries. So yeah, that day was happy, right? They come back with a couple of bottles of spirits, said that's all that was in there, and we got off. And then it turns out a couple of days later, I'd heard they'd been scoring off some other kid, so they'd obviously got money out of there. Yeah, it was Flynn, the new driver, said, I know where there's a house with loads of money in.
Previous burglaries, John had only ever done the door knock to see if someone was home, but the others didn't share with him the money they stole, so this time he would go inside.
And so I'm thinking this time, well, if we go and I don't go in, they're just going to have the money off again, so I'm going to have to go in with them. So that's why, yeah, I went in this time with them. Mm-hmm. Do you think it was just going dark, about 5 o'clock, I'm going up to the door. Yeah, so I'm at his door now and I'm knocking, there's no answer. I've even shouted through the letterbox. There's no answer. So yeah, I went back and said, there's no one in. There's no answer. And they've immediately come out, come to the door and kicked the door in. Kicked the door in and gone up 2 flights of steps.
How many of you went in?
3 of us, me and my 2 drivers. I was at the back. We've opened the door in front of us, or they have walked in, and that's the living room. As soon as I've gone in behind them, I can see the old man sat in the corner. And you can tell straight away there's nothing in the house. It's just an old man's house with... pretty messy as well, you know, it wasn't very clean. So yeah, straight away I'm saying there's nothing in here, we just might as well leave. And this is the crux of it, I guess a lot of people are going to think, well, you're a drug addict, you're a smackhead. Just because you're a drug addict don't mean you go to do these mad, evil, decrepit things. I like to think I was brought up well. I don't agree with it in old men, old people. So yeah, I just wanted out of there. It wasn't right that we was in there. The guy was obviously petrified, so I was then come to the dilemma of, do I just leave? I can just leave, but then I'm just leaving him to do whatever happens. I don't know what's going to happen. So I stayed, and I only stayed to try and get them out of the house. My only purpose for staying, I just wanted them out to get out of the house. So I've gone into the bedroom where me original driver is, said, listen, we need to get out of here, this is madness. And he's agreed, we've gone back into the living room where Flynn is. He's at the other end of the living room now with the guy, and then he just punches him.
The 71-year-old man falls to the floor. John screams at Flynn, and he actually goes to help Mr. Madamasia. He lifts him back into the chair and sees that he's got a bloody nose, but so far as he could tell, that was it.
I was just trying to get them out of the house, and I hope people understand that, and don't, you know, just because you're a drug addict don't mean you lose all sense of morals and principles and stuff. So yeah, I just left the house then, and they come out about a minute and a half later with some kind of food blender or something. Literally nothing.
And the reason we're dwelling on this story of the burglary is that later Augustine Madamasia died from the blow to the head inflicted by David Flynn.
Like I said, I didn't have the drugs to sell now, so I was just going into town trying to shoplift. I'd been mooching about and I couldn't find out, and I was just walking back out of town, and I just got half a mile out of town, and just police just pulled up beside me. I think they've seen me in town, just followed me. Yeah, just jumped out beside me, 2 vans. And a film crew, they had a film crew with them. So yeah, I just got jumped on by loads of them and a film crew with a camera in my face telling me I was arrested for murder. And like I say, the guy only had a bloody nose. I didn't think, the last thing I thought, he was going to die. He didn't look like there was anything wrong with him. But yeah, sadly, obviously he died. And I was arrested for murder.
3 months after his arrest, the police found David Flynn, the man who actually threw the punch. He got 25 years for murder. But before he knew it, John Crilly too had been sent down for murder and got 20 years.
What they say about being in the dock, about the leg going and all that, definitely true. I remember just struggling to stand up. Like, yeah, in that life and 20 years, it does take the wind out of you. Literally takes the wind out of you. I can't believe this has happened. Like, how have I been convicted of murder? I've not touched nobody. I never wanted anyone to get hurt. So yeah, I was just lost then. I was just thinking, I just took it on like it's just another shit thing in my life. That's all. I've just wallowed in self-pity for years.
John had been found guilty because of the legal concept of joint enterprise. It didn't matter that he didn't touch Mr. Matamasia. The judge directed that the jury should consider whether John should have been able to foresee that Flynn could commit the act of violence that became a murder. And if they thought he could, then they should find him guilty. So let's talk about joint enterprise. It's a doctrine of criminal law which permits two or more defendants to be convicted of the same criminal offence in relation to the same incident, even where they had different types or levels of involvement in the incident. So you can see, one person deals the blow, another one might be present, but both could be facing the same charge. For centuries, it had been established in criminal law that an individual who was intentionally assisted or encouraged another to commit an offence can be held liable for that offence, and that both individuals can be convicted even if it isn't known which of them committed the essential act and which was the accessory. But in recent years, there's been a growing controversy over the doctrine of joint enterprise and how it's brought into effect in the courts. It seemed to be increasingly used by prosecutors to get convictions for the most serious offences on the basis of really highly peripheral involvement in the criminal acts. In some cases, people were convicted of murder even though they weren't present and didn't know the violence had taken place. And in John Crilly's case, he hadn't wanted to go in the house and he'd actively tried to make the others leave when he saw that there was someone in there.
And they've given me an 18-year sentence for a one-punch murder that I didn't throw.
John found himself facing decades locked up, missing his children growing up, and in the throes of addiction, he continued to turn to drugs.
I probably thought this was written for me. This was where my life's supposed to go. I was going over every other day, injecting drugs. I was overdosing every other day, getting upset if I didn't. Go over. I was gone. I was fucked.
For years, this was John's life, just barely existing. But it was the summer of 2010, almost 5 years after his sentencing, that something changed. He was in his prison cell, reading a paper, and saw an advert.
Can you tell me when you started to clean up in prison?
Probably when I seen the Jengbir adverts in the paper. Probably when I started noticing there was something out there that could probably help me.
So which paper and what adverts, what were they saying?
Oh, it was a prison paper on it, Inside Times. Just a prison paper with the advert for Jengba saying, have you been locked up under joint enterprise recently? Did your judge use directions of possible foresight and stuff? So yeah, I just seen that and fitted all of it. It had all happened on my case. So yeah, I just wrote back to him. And from then, that day on, I think just that little bit of hope or support or belief. So yeah, sadly, I think that life sentence saved my life, which is hard because somebody died. But that's the truth of it, I think.
Hello, it's Tomini from Tortoise. This podcast is sponsored by EY. Senior business leaders in the UK are keen to harness AI, but there's a complex regulatory maze emerging globally. The OECD, a group of the world's richest countries, which includes the UK, has adopted a new set of principles to ensure that AI operates in a way that's safe, fair, and trustworthy. The principles are wide-ranging, but in essence, call for AI systems to be designed in a way that respects the rule of law and human rights, and says there should be transparency around their use. By embracing the core principles of responsible innovation, UK business leaders can better explore sector-specific opportunities and emerging trends without compromising on citizens' trust. Find out more at ey.ai. Hello, it's Tomini from Tortoise. This podcast is sponsored by EY. UK business leaders are quietly confident that better times are coming. More than half of those who responded to the recent EY CEO Outlook survey believe their profitability would increase in 2024. As businesses look to the future, transformation is clearly front and centre on the 2024 CEO agenda, with the vast majority of leaders planning to maintain or accelerate their transformational change in 2024. With 76% of CEOs in agreement that AI will deliver transformative efficiency benefits to their organisation, how can AI be put to use to enhance innovation efforts? Find out how integrating AI into your business could minimise the negative impacts on the workforce, boost productivity, and improve overall employee experience by reading the full report at ey.com. Hello, it's Tomini from Tortoise. This podcast is sponsored by EY. The risks posed by AI range from bias in decision-making to misinformation and the misuse of personal information, all at an unprecedented scale. Nearly a quarter of UK businesses understand that the regulatory landscape is changing fast, and nearly half are tracking new regulatory guidance to be responsive to emerging best practice. The EY Responsible AI Service helps organisations innovate safely, providing confidence that AI and generative AI technologies are developed and managed ethically, transparently, and sustainably, and that potential regulatory and reputational risks are identified and mitigated. Discover how you can create a better working world with AI by going to ey.ai.
My name's Jan Cunliffe, and I'm the mother of Jordan Cunliffe, who was convicted of murder in 2008.
Jordan Cunliffe is arguably one of the more high-profile examples of joint enterprise. He was convicted of the murder of Gary Newlove, a man who had come out of his house to remonstrate with teenagers.
There were two groups of teenagers that were walking down the street that night. The first group had damaged a mini digger, and that was the reason why Gary Newlove came out of his house. Now, they'd already scarpered up the street and gone.
And when that case was going on, John Crilly was already locked up, overdosing daily, he says. It's August 2007 in Warrington, a town that sits between Liverpool and Manchester.
When Gary Newlove came out, he came out to the wrong set of teenagers, not the ones that had damaged the mini digger, and he chased them up the street. I think Stephen Sorton threw a jab at him, which hit him on the cheek. And as he was moving away from Stephen, as far as I'm aware, he sort of stumbled. And as he's stumbling to the ground, that's when Stephen Sorton kicked him. And unfortunately, because the blow hit him in the neck, a blood vessel burst in his neck. That is the reason why Gary Newlove died.
For Jan, the idea Jordan, who didn't get involved in the assault, could be charged with murder, was absurd because her son has seriously impaired vision and he's registered blind.
When you're blind and you can't actually see where you are and it's very dark, it's very difficult for someone to pinpoint exactly where they were. He does know that he was at the scene after the violence because he heard the commotion of who's done this, what has happened to my dad, which would have been one of Gary Newlove's daughters, and he moved towards her voice to see if she was okay, because he said there were, you know, quite highly pitched screams and quite upset. And he's never denied that. And he then walked to the bottom of the street where he met two community support police officers and told them that something had happened to a man down the street and to make sure the ambulance came in the right direction, because at the bottom of the street there was a subway that no traffic could go through. In his own mind, he thought he was helping, only to find that he became a defendant.
In January 2008, Jordan was sentenced to a minimum 12-year term, along with two others.
That was the prosecutor's argument, that he was at the scene. And I always thought that mere presence at the scene wasn't enough to convict you. But that really was the strength of the prosecution case, that he was at the scene. And it was about trying to find out whether he was there before or whether he was there after. And obviously when you're confused and you don't know whether you're there before or after, it was difficult for Jordan to explain. I mean, Jordan didn't defend himself against the possibility of foresight. He defended himself against murder.
What Jan's referring to here is the idea that a secondary co-accused had foresight that the principal attacker might carry out a killing, and that that might be enough proof of their guilt in assisting or encouraging them. In other words, intent wasn't just encouraging or assisting with the murder in some way, but merely through a presence on the scene or contact beforehand, the defendant could know that a murder could happen. It's an interpretation that dated back to a 1984 case and became established case law after that as a succession of other trials were conducted on the same basis. 16-year-old Jordan Cunliffe might not have seen what was happening, but his presence was sufficient to prove foresight. All across the country, hundreds were being convicted on similar grounds. Sometimes the defendant wasn't at the scene, other times people with no criminal record and no involvement in the crime itself were being sentenced. And there's a report actually by the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, and it found that there were three times as many young black men serving life sentences as a result of joint enterprise convictions than there are in the general prison population. In 2017, 11 teenagers were jailed for a total time of 168 years on joint enterprise. Something was going badly wrong. In 2009, Jan appeared on a BBC Panorama programme about Jordan's case, where she met another woman called Gloria Morrison. Her son's best friend had been convicted on joint enterprise. And after the programme, other people started contacting these two women.
And that's basically where we started. It was two women on the telephone, basically, most nights of the week, trying to work out what we needed to do.
So they got together and they created Joint Enterprise Not Guilty by Association, or JENGBA for short. And they started putting out these ads in the prison newspaper, going out all across the country. 160 people responded to them, including John. To mark the occasion, in September 2010, they released 160 red balloons with the names of every single prisoner who'd been in touch. And John, well, now he had some hope, and he actually started turning things around.
I just started going to education and stuff, I think, doing GCSEs and stuff. When I passed my first GCSE, I thought, I tried to do something different and started getting off the drugs then, I think. Yeah, it was amazing.
Jan and Gloria at JENGBA started compiling the cases, seeing what could be done. And the one that seemed to keep on running, well, it really took Jan by surprise. In 2012, Amin Joji was convicted on joint enterprise grounds to 20 years in prison for the murder of a former policeman called Paul Fife in 2011. A Court of Appeal hearing later revised that down to 18 years, but it was Amin's case that ended up making it all the way to the Supreme Court. There were cases where the defendants hadn't even been at the scene of the crime, but it was judges that had gone all the way.
We didn't think that that was going to be the best case, because most of them, when you look at them, could be the best case. And it was just the tenacity of Amin Joji's QC, Felicity Gerry, who, in her eyes, could see the devastation it causes to families and to mothers, because she's a mother herself. And she fought that case to the Supreme Court. Most legal teams run out of steam once you've been convicted. They can't make any money out of appeals, and they really don't want to hold on to your case to get it so far. But Felicity Gerry was the kind of QC that wasn't going to let this drop.
It was a remarkable moment. As Lord Neuberger delivered his judgment, there was an audible gasp. You can just about hear it.
In a unanimous judgment, the court today concludes that the development was wrong as a matter of law. The cases relied on for it do not properly support it. There were others which were against it.
The courts had spoken. Joji's joint enterprise conviction was wrong. The law had taken a wrong turn.
The court is satisfied, after a much fuller review of the law than in the earlier cases, that the court took a wrong turn in 1984, and it is the responsibility of this court to put the law right.
This idea of foresight that Jan had spoken about, the principle that had stemmed from the 1984 case, was flawed. And so, for 32 years, hundreds of joint enterprise convictions had been based on a wrongful interpretation of the law. Change, it seemed, was on the horizon, and within a year of the Supreme Court's decision, the Criminal Cases Review Commission had received 99 applications citing the ruling. Jengba's caseload grew into the hundreds. Yet if it seemed the floodgates had been opened by the Supreme Court, progress was slow. When that Supreme Court judgment was delivered, it had a little understood clause that said cases would not automatically be referred for appeal. Instead, substantial injustice would have to be proved. But meanwhile, John Crilly, in Grendon Prison studying for a law degree, well, he was still hopeful. In 2018, John finally got his day in court.
Obviously, there's been appeals before mine, or permission to for leave to appeal, and they've all been knocked back. And I'm thinking, fucking hell, I'm criminal. I'm not purely innocent, am I? And there's cases going before us who've never been in trouble in the police before in their lives and getting refused appeals. So I'm thinking, this is going nowhere. How can they just keep knocking all these cases back? So anyway, mine's gone. I think they've originally given me leave to appeal. They've initially found it was unsafe. My trial was unsafe. So therefore quashed it.
He'd done it. John had become the first person to successfully quash a joint enterprise murder conviction since the Supreme Court ruling 2 years earlier. But he wasn't out of the woods yet. His conviction was ruled unsafe, but he was remanded for a retrial, and he still had to prove his innocence.
They started hitting me then with the manslaughter. Do you want the manslaughter?
We're getting here to what happens when the justice system gets something badly, systemically wrong, but can't really face the consequences of its mistakes. Remember, the Supreme Court said the law on joint enterprise had taken a wrong turn, but prosecutors didn't want to lose their conviction in John's case or accept the stain of a miscarriage of justice. They wanted John Crilly to stand trial again, but in the holding cell below the courtroom, they offered him a guilty plea to the lesser charge of manslaughter. If he took the deal, he'd be freed. But the prosecutors would still have their conviction, and John's case would not be recorded as a miscarriage of justice. John wanted to prove his innocence, but he was torn. If he pleaded guilty to manslaughter, he'd get to walk free, finally get to see his two sons properly. But he'd then have that conviction hanging over his head.
You're just downstairs at the bottom of the court cell, you're in the court cells all day. And yeah, I was in there for about an hour and a half before I went to court. And I went to court, I was only in there 20 minutes, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Pleaded, he said that time served, let him out sort of thing. It's probably the biggest regret of my life now that I took it. I took the manslaughter. I should have run it.
He'd been convicted of manslaughter, with a sentence that meant he would serve 9 years, but he'd already served 13. So John was released. Except it still wasn't quite over. Instead of being able to walk to freedom in front of the cameras outside of the court in the middle of Manchester, he was ferried back to Preston, to prison, to be slipped out quietly.
But that night, you were released. What was the scene?
Just me stood outside Preston prison with a couple of bags, trying to find a phone box. Yeah, I was just left throughout outside Preston Nick, left to find my own way home.
Are you given any money when you leave prison?
£46, isn't it? It's not changed from 1987, that. £46 discharge, yeah.
We haven't talked.
So I went straight to the railway station. Mm-hmm. I started buying cigarettes I'd stopped smoking for 8 years. I can have 20 Bensons, 4 cans of Stella. And who's left the bags on the platform? I definitely know about all that, did I?
Yeah, yeah. What was it? I mean, what was it like being out in the world and, able to make your own decisions for the first time?
It was amazing. I was just spinning. It was amazing.
It's April 2018, and John's finally a free man. But since he has a manslaughter conviction, he's still on probation. Once he was out, John stayed involved in an education program called Learning Together. He'd been part of it when he was in prison, studying alongside Cambridge University students who were doing the same criminology module for their law degrees. He met and became friends with a bunch of them, and especially with a young man called Jack Merritt. For John, it was one of the few truly positive experiences he has to reminisce about.
It was just an initiative to get 10 Cambridge students doing a module, a degree module, with 10 prisoners. So they used to just come together every week in a room, have lectures, do feedback stuff, and yeah, basically just do a module together. And but it was really good. It was really good in building up your self-esteem and your self-worth. And one of the best things I've ever done in prison, definitely, for like your self-esteem, self-worth, for changing you, for making you see what's possible. Mm-hmm. I never imagined I could sit down and study next to a Cambridge student. You're mad. And then the year after, I was a mentor on it, on the same course. Just helping a lad if they needed any advice or if they didn't know what how to. Because obviously a lot of the prisoners have never studied like that before.
John struggled to find regular work and stable housing since his release, but working with Jengba and on Learning Together as a mentor for other prisoners, that's given him purpose. But life, it seems, wasn't quite done with John. It was the 29th of November, 2019. It was the 5-year anniversary of Learning Together. John was travelling down to London with friends from the programme, and it was meant to be a day of celebration with an event near London Bridge.
Well, I was in a hostel in the middle of town back then.
In Cambridge?
Yeah, under the flyover it was. I just left there in the morning to meet another lad who was in Grendon, who'd been released, and two of the coordinators of it who run it were supposed to go down with us, but we got there and the other lad who'd been in Grendon was late, so me and a bloke called Simon, who worked for Lynn together, agreed we'd go down it as planned, and then Jack Merritt, he was going to wait for Gareth to turn up and then follow us down.
It's the morning of the 29th of November and you're at Cambridge station.
Yeah.
There's you, there's your friend Jack, and you're waiting for someone who hasn't showed up.
Yeah.
So what happens next?
So Jack said he'll wait for Gareth, and me and Simon go ahead because we have to pick up some kid in London, Khan. We only get told this on the way down. We just got to pick some other kid up on the way. He doesn't know his way there.
So you get the train to King's Cross?
Somewhere like that, yeah, I think King's Cross, yeah. And then we start going through all the turnstiles and that.
Yeah.
And my bag splits. Straight away, I've spilt coffee on, because I'm going up to Manchester after this event to see my kids, so I've got all my clothes with me. Mm-hmm. So I've spilt, coffee's gone all over it, bags are ripped. I'm just in a bad mood now. Mm. So when we get off the train going through the tube stations, turnstiles won't work. I'm just getting madder and madder. Mm-hmm. To the point where Sam goes, you know what, just wait here, I'll go and get him, because we've got to come back this way anyway. So he went off, got Khan, come back. I just said that, just literally, this is John, this is Osman. He didn't really look at me. Mm-hmm. He just like looked past me. And I just walked behind him then all the way to Fishmonger. It wasn't that far really, about 5 minutes to Fishmonger's Hall.
Mm-hmm. So what happened when you got there? It's on London Bridge, right?
Nothing, because my bags were messed up and all that. As soon as you've gone in the room, there was tables here with all like your name tags, and I just went behind there and started trying to sort my bags out. I didn't even notice where Simon and Khan went. So yeah, I was just doing that for a bit, and then I went outside for a smoke, and they'd all got off as part of the course that they do. So they'd all split up and gone into different rooms, so I just went out again. It was just after dinner time. They'd all just start coming back in the room, and I seen a Judge John Samuels. John Samuels QC was my mentor, but I'd not seen him. I was wanting to talk to him, and we went out on the balcony to have a chat. Just all started screaming, just pure mad screaming.
So you're on the stairs?
Yeah, above it all, yeah.
And what did you hear?
Just like mad screams, wretched screaming, yeah. And crying and stuff, but just looking at each other thinking, is that someone messing about? And then it just suddenly got a lot louder and more. Yeah, there was obviously something going on. So yeah, we just made our way down the stairs, as we, big posh staircase, as we come down to the middle bit, we come across Saskia at the top of the stairs with a throat cut, and Khan just a couple of steps in front of her, jumping about.
And so your first, you'd seen him, you'd met him on the tube. What was he, what was his demeanour, what was he looking like when you saw him?
He was just like, he wasn't even really looking at you when I first met him. He just had like his head down. He seems very distant. I don't think, like, he wasn't even there.
And then you come down the, well, you...
When I come down the stairs, he was jumping about like a lunatic with his knives on it. He was totally different, like, obviously going nuts.
Knives in both hands.
Yeah.
He's got, just tell me what he's wearing.
Wearing a big blue puffer jacket.
And he opens the jacket to show you, or...?
Well, the jacket was open.
Mm-hmm. And what could you see?
You just see the front of the belt, the wires and shit coming off it. For shit, he's got a fucking suicide belt on. So, yeah, Gareth stopped with Saskia. And I carried on to try and stop him, try and distract him, whatever I was going to do. I wasn't even sure what I was going to do, I didn't know. Obviously, I just started screaming, what the fuck's going on, what are you doing? And I could see behind him in the back was Izzy was killed. I didn't know it was Izzy at the time, just a woman curled up in a ball and like blood trickling down the side from her. I was going to this my guy, lunacy, what the fuck's going on, man? What are you doing? And he's obviously coming trying to swipe from her. Then I have to get another woman out of his way. And it's just like trying to stay out of his way, really, keep him occupied. I don't know what I'm waiting for, but I know someone's going to come eventually, innit? So it was just trying to distract him and stuff. Obviously there was nothing there. I would have picked up some lectern, it was the only thing there. I threw that at him, he just bounced off him, smashed. So he's come back for me then, and I've got nothing. And I'm backing off again, picked up a bit of the lectern that I'd smashed, threw that at him. I was just like that for a minute or something. He was trying to get up the stairs, but I just kept throwing things at him and he didn't get up there, and then he suddenly just turned back round and started running backwards towards the door. He was running to Izzy, back to the girl who was already bleeding. It took me a second to realise what's going on. So I started running after him then, but he plunged her twice before I got there. I just had seen the third one go in. I managed to pick up a chair and hit him with it.
And what happened? Did that stop him?
Well, yeah, he went flying across the room and then just jumped back up again. But obviously got him away from Izzy, but... And then he come back for me again, and then I think Darren and Steve turned up then with the tusk. But when they've come then, obviously I've seen them come with the tusk and that. So I've took that moment to go and find something else. And I run down this corridor and there's fuck all there, and right at the bottom is the extinguisher. And I think I'll just throw this at him.
Mm-hmm.
But then I sort of picked up and I'm walking up to him and I'm holding it. And fuck, I might just spray this fucking hose on that belt.
Yeah. So come on then, you've got this fire extinguisher now. What's in your head?
Well, I'm just thinking I'll just spray this and soak the thing, if nothing else, hopefully. I don't know, I think I'll just throw it at him. But when I've got back up to him and I've sprayed him with it, very noticeably affected him. He's not liking it one bit, obviously he can't see, he's blinding him.
Mm.
And he can see he proper, obviously he's going nuts anyway, but that proper riles him up. I'm buzzing then, thinking, wow, this is great. He can't even see where he's going. I'm like, he's trying to chase him. And he's trying to get away from it then. Which hopefully sent him out the door. Made him go for the door. Follow him outside, yeah.
There's how many of you by this point?
Three of us. Me, Steve and Darren.
And Darren's got the...
The tusk.
Yeah.
Yeah, so... We just followed him up the bridge, shouting to people to get out the fucking way.
Mm-hmm.
And he kept turning around trying to... scared us off, whatever. I just went perfect. I sprayed him with it again, blinded him for a second, which meant Darren got a proper dig with him with the tusk, mm-hmm. which knocked him off balance, and then Steve was just in the right place to one-arm him, so that armbar him, and he just went to the floor.
And all of you jumped on him?
Quick.
Did
yeah.
you?
Yeah, straight on his hand, yeah. And I took my knife out of his hand, and I turned it round and used the handle and started hitting him in the temple with it. Because I still think he's got a belt. I don't know what's going on. And the police was there, literally straight away.
What happened next?
They just keep shouting at us to get off a minute. We're going, he's got a fucking bomb on him, let go of his hand. And just said, get off him. So me and Dan got off him, and I think they have to pull Darren off him. Me and Steve got off him, and they have to pull Darren off him. And just shoot him. That was basically it. Took us all back in. And that was it.
It's an astonishing thing to have to experience.
It was, yeah.
Do you think about that a lot?
Yeah, all that just haunts me all the time, that. And then we find out Jack's been killed as well. Didn't know about Jack at that time. Jack wasn't in the area, like, visible. He was in an office. I didn't even know about Jack then.
Can you tell me what that makes you feel?
Just sick, sad. He was just a... Jack was special. I know everyone says it, but he was. He just had a big mad smile. As soon as he walked in the room, you noticed him. Yeah, he just seemed dead cool, everything about him, the way he dressed.
Mm-hmm.
And he was really open and very welcoming. Just lost.
John Crilly was a hero that day, the 29th of November 2019. He's not received any measure of thanks from the state, but Jack Merritt's dad popped round the other day with some new kitchen things for him to help him get set up in his new place. And it only occurred to me after I'd left John that his story's bookended by two life-changing moments that both turn on episodes of Joint Enterprise. The burglary and a terrorist attack. He went into the burglary, a weak and reluctant man. He tried to stop it, but a court judged he should have foreseen what might happen, what others might do inside that house, and found him guilty on the basis of joint enterprise of a murder that he did not commit. And 14 years later, on that terrible day at London Bridge, John was part of another act of joint enterprise. Armed only with a fire extinguisher, he and two others joined forces to bring down an armed terrorist who had just murdered two people. In the first episode, he wanted to stop. In the second, he pressed on, fully understanding that he might die. What does it all tell us? That people can change? That people aren't universally good or evil? Maybe that weakness and strength, resilience and fragility coexist in all of us. There's something else. John's free now, but you know, when you meet him, he's still imprisoned by his past. And he's lonely in more ways than one. 5 years after that revolutionary Supreme Court judgment, after many failed appeals by many prisoners, John remains the only person to have successfully overturned their joint enterprise murder conviction. The law was wrong, but the injustice remains. Jengba has more than 1,500 people now on its books trying to pursue an appeal. But what they're fighting against is every bit as vague as the joint enterprise law that condemned them in the first place, because to overturn it, they need to prove they've been a victim of substantial injustice. And what qualifies as substantial injustice? Well, it's anyone's guess.
Well, they call it substantial injustice. So unless you can prove that you have suffered a substantial injustice, then you don't have the right to appeal. Now, the grey area there is, what is a substantial injustice? I would say that, you know, anyone who's been convicted of a murder that they haven't committed is a substantial injustice. Even the judges won't tell us what that is. You know, we're trying to find out what is it? What rules and what line do you have to follow in order to prove that? The CCRC are looking at cases and saying that you haven't passed that test. You know, but what is that test? Can you tell us what that test is? And I truly don't believe there is anyone out there that can actually tell us what that test is.
Jan has her son back now. Jordan was released last year. He wasn't freed on appeal. He'd just served his time. So he's out. Albeit still monitored and heavily restricted as to where he can live and travel. And as his mother puts it, he's a 15-year-old in the body of a 30-year-old man. Jan could rest, but she won't.
I can rest when I'm dead. Yeah. Yeah. When an injustice burns inside of you, it doesn't just go out. It doesn't go out. Once that fire catches, it's inside of you forever. And I don't think I'll ever stop. It's the fire's inside of me and it won't ever go out.
With Gloria and the team at Jengba, she's still campaigning for clarification on substantial injustice and to change the law to make it easier for more people to appeal. For now, this part of the law is a very uncertain place, and it's much like John's life of wrong turns. The promise of freedom always just out of reach.
Have you got friends in Cambridge?
Not really, no. Not really know anyone.
Do you know?
No. Just the Cambridge lot.
Uh-huh.
You work there. But no, not really.
What do you do when you go out? I mean, do you get any sort of pleasure from walking around the city?
Yeah, Cambridge is gorgeous. There's loads of lovely places, isn't it? Like walking down by the river and that.
Mm-hmm.
Or going for walks up in the hills a bit.
Mm-hmm.
There's loads of places to go. And it's nice.
Thanks for listening. This episode was reported by me, David Taylor, produced by Matt Russell, with original music by Tom Kinsella. And if you'd like to listen to the Slow Newscast without ads, or if you'd like to get involved in our journalism, you can become a member of our newsroom. Just go to tortoisemedia.com/friend and use my code DAVE50. That's DAVE50. Thanks, and see you next week.
Hello, it's Tomini from Tortoise. This podcast is sponsored by EY. Safe, efficient, and reliable railways help to keep us all connected, thanks to Network Rail. Yet, maintenance on the railways is a risky and sometimes fatal business. At Network Rail, two previous attempts to invigorate its track worker safety programs had failed, leaving employees feeling sceptical that the organisation could ever get railway safety right. Since 2019, EY teams have worked with Network Rail to deliver a transformation that improved safety protocols and changed employee behaviour around safety. Network Rail RailHub, a new digital safety platform and app, eliminated inaccurate paper trails and worked offline, so it could be used by workers in remote locations. Since the platform was introduced, near misses affecting maintenance workers on the railways have fallen by 40%. Read the full story at ey.com. Hello, it's Tomini from Tortoise. This podcast is sponsored by EY. UK business leaders are quietly confident that better times are coming. More than half of those who responded to the recent EY CEO Outlook survey believe their profitability would increase in 2024. As businesses look to the future, transformation is clearly front and centre on the 2024 CEO agenda, with the vast majority of leaders planning to maintain or accelerate their transformational change in 2024. With 76% of CEOs in agreement that AI will deliver transformative efficiency benefits to their organisation, how can AI be put to use to enhance innovation efforts? Find out how integrating AI into your business could minimise the negative impacts on the workforce, boost productivity, and improve overall employee experience by reading the full report at ey.com. Hello, it's Tomini from Tortoise. This podcast is sponsored by EY. Senior business leaders in the UK are keen to harness AI, but there's a complex regulatory maze emerging globally. The OECD, a group of the world's richest countries, which includes the UK, has adopted a new set of principles to ensure that AI operates in a way that's safe, fair, and trustworthy. The principles are wide-ranging, but in essence call for AI systems to be designed in a way that respects the rule of law and human rights, and says there should be transparency around their use. By embracing the core principles of responsible innovation, UK business leaders can better explore sector-specific opportunities and emerging trends without compromising on citizens' trust. Find out more at ey.ai.